Well, hey, everyone. For this week's culture segment, I get to introduce you to a new friend to the Boundless Show. His name is Clay Scroggins. Welcome, Clay.
Thank you, Lisa. So, honestly, so glad to be able to do this, and I'm excited about this conversation.
Well, this is going to be a lot of fun, because when I saw this book title come across my desk, I was like, oh, my word, that's where the Boundless audience is living right now. So we need to talk to him. In addition to writing books, and I'm going to tell you right now, the title of this is How to Lead When You're Not in Charge. And the sub on that is Leveraging Influence When You Lack Authority. And all of you just collectively went, oh, my word, that's me.
That's right. That's pretty much all of us, honestly.
When Clay isn't writing this book, he just happens to be the lead pastor of North Point Community Church outside of Atlanta. And he works. This is kind of a nice gig. You're going to be like, what in the world does Clay Scroggins have to say about this topic? Because he's lead pastor of this church and works for Andy Stanley, people. Come on now. But you've had quite the little journey throughout your professional life in getting there and moving into ministry positions and leading. And that's what we want to talk about today. So this is going to be a fun conversation for sure. Okay, so I want to kick it off. You have a degree in industrial engineering, and so I don't,
yes.
I'm going to be honest, I don't even know what that is. What is that?
Okay.
Yeah, you're going to have to tell us what that means.
Yeah, you know the term supply chain, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Supply chain is basically how do you get raw materials into a finished product, really ultimately into the customer's hands.
Okay.
And yeah, I went to college, majored in engineering, Georgia Tech. And Atlanta has a great industrial engineering program.
Mm-hmm.
And I joke when people find out that I have this degree, but it's almost serious. But I told Georgia Tech, I will promise to never use this degree if you will give it to me. Because I was so desperate to graduate.
Oh, my word.
And I shouldn't have been an engineering student, but I was stubborn. Most people start in engineering at Georgia Tech and then move into some other degree. And I just was determined to not be, was determined to finish it. And I did, and did not really use it much.
Okay.
So, but I'm grateful for what it taught me. So.
Well, I'm guessing, this isn't scientific and I didn't actually read it anywhere, but I'm guessing that most graduates in industrial engineering become pastors.
It's a quite popular pipeline, right? Directly in the ministry. You're exactly right.
And now we found out why you had to write this book. Okay, that's good.
Right.
Okay, well, then as if that's not weird enough, you actually have a doctorate with an emphasis in online church. So I just have to ask you about that, because what in the world? What, that is actually an emphasis, a degree? What is that about?
Well, when you do a doctorate, you can write your dissertation about anything you want, honestly. And at the time, we had just, we were a couple of years into our online, I don't know, we just call it a stream, but at the time we probably would have called it a campus. But yeah, and I just was passionate about it because I felt like, okay, this feels like the future. I was working in student ministry. I don't know why, I just didn't want to write about anything in student ministry, so I picked that topic to write about. And I had some, at the time, there was some crossover in my job, had a little bit of influence with our online service, and yeah, that's what I wrote on. It was interesting because I think I finished that in 2013, but I started it in maybe 2010, so that's only 7 years ago, but I was doing my degree at Dallas Theological Seminary, and there was not a church in the Dallas Metroplex that I knew of that had a full-on online campus. There were some people that were streaming their service, but in 2010, there wasn't anyone with an online campus, and man, has that changed. I mean, now it's hard to find a church that doesn't have some sort of online footprint with their service. So
yeah, okay.
It's become outdated quickly.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's interesting, because I want to back up and go in. You know, you mentioned, so it's not like you haven't gotten degrees. You did. You got an education. You went to Georgia Tech. You got a master's.
Yep.
You got a doctorate from DTS. And but tell us about, like, when you had your degree in hand, whether,
yep,
you know, whether you're undergrad or beyond, What, going back to as far as you can remember, what were your plans for that? And how did that play into, were you even considering yourself as a leader at this point? Because I know in the book you talk about, and you can tread into this space a little bit, of the assumption we make that leadership is power, title, and authority. But what were your plans as a young lad there?
Well, I wanted to play professional baseball, but short and slow. But I open up the book with the line, "I've always wanted to be a leader," because that's interwoven in my story. Is that I have always sought out leadership positions, but my problem was, it dates back as far as I can remember. I mean, even in school, I was so reluctant to step out and lead unless I had some sort of formal position of leadership. So in high school, my senior class election, I ran for president because I thought, leaders have positions. And there's nothing wrong with that. Positions certainly do help leadership. But just because someone has a title doesn't make them a leader, and just because someone doesn't have a title doesn't mean they can't be a leader. So that's been a huge enlightenment for me over the past few years, that honestly I think it took moving into this campus pastor role for me to figure that out. Campus pastoring is odd. There are so many multi-site churches now all over the world, and it's a new form of church, and it's created this new job title. I mean, most people know what a youth pastor is, and that's what I did for about 6 years. But moving into this campus pastor role, I'm essentially the leader of a franchise location, in a sense, but I don't have all the authority. Most Sundays, I have the most authority at this campus, but I don't have full-on authority to be able to make every decision that I think needs to be made. And so that paralyzed me for a couple of years. That caused me to be reluctant. It caused me to sit on my hands or throw my hands up in passivity instead of doing what I now think could have been done to cultivate influence to be able to lead. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it is a significant part of my journey. It's not just something I want for people or something I'm trying to tell people. It really is. It's me hoping to put my arm around people and saying, "Hey, I know what it feels like to not be in charge, yet still have a desire to lead. And it is possible from whatever seat you're in."
Yeah. Well, which is kind of like super weird, because you're actually the lead pastor at one of the largest, you know, congregations in America, but then yet you feel like you have this awkward feeling of knowing you're not in charge, but still having a ton of responsibility in that role. Okay, well, let's back it up, because my understanding, you can tell me if this is correct or not, but I think I remember reading that at North Point, you actually started as a facilities intern.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So first summer of college for me, I wanted to be a student ministry. I wanted to intern in our student ministry here at North Point. I was going to school in Atlanta at Georgia Tech, attending North Point. And at the time, I think they only had a spot for one intern, and they had already hired that person. And I found out that they needed help in our facilities team, and so I applied for the job, and I got it. I remember sweeping the auditorium, and Andy would come in there on study breaks and come play the piano in the auditorium. And it was such a vivid memory for me, because I remember, you know, as a college student, I looked up to him. I still do. He's such a huge influence in my life, and look up to him with so much respect. And, that was a humbling but helpful way to start. But everybody started there. Everybody started as some kind of intern. And it's interesting now to be on this side, to be on the other side of interns, to be able to look at interns and say, "I don't know what you think you can do in this internship, but you have the potential to change a lot more than you think you can change."
Yeah.
And I deeply believe that's true.
Yeah. Well, what I think is important to say, what I think you're implying here, is that Andy did not finish playing the piano and then walk up to you and say, drop that broom because I need you to be lead pastor.
Yeah, this is the best swept floor okay. I've ever seen.
Right.
No, I don't think he knew my name.
Okay, so see, that's helpful. That's helpful because I often jokingly right. tell our audience, many of whom are in their 20s and into their 30s, you know, you're not going to graduate from college and be on the stage at Passion. Okay, so let's all just get...
No.
Okay, so that said, you mentioned Andy. I want you to talk a little bit about, I mean, you basically have referred to him as one of the greatest leaders on the planet. What specifically... because I think it's very easy for people who have that kind of public ministry to just get all about themselves and be like, I'm just a rock star and whatever. What specifically, what are the principles that you have learned about leadership from him? And where do you think he cultivated those? How did it pass along down the chain?
Well, I think, I mean, I don't want to put words into his mouth, but most of what I see from him are notes that he took when he worked for organizations that he felt like were more frustrating for people than fuel for people. And he's worked in a couple of churches, he would say, I think, that they were not places that empowered people and gave people both authority and they gave people responsibility, but maybe not the authority that they needed to be able to lead well. And he clearly is reacting to that in a very healthy way. And he's created an organization where I feel empowered to lead no matter where my position is. And it took me a while to learn that. And I know you're saying, oh, well, you're the lead pastor of a large campus. I've got so many bosses, Lisa. I've got more bosses than I think I could count. And I don't report directly to Andy. I report to someone who reports directly to Andy. And I know what it feels like to have bosses that, you know, you've got an idea, something you think you need to change, an idea you think you need to chase, and the boss steps in and says, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to head a different direction. Or you have a meeting, and everybody decides on the idea, and you leave the meeting, and you spend a couple weeks working on it, putting legs and putting hands and feet on the idea and trying to start executing the idea, only to find out that the boss has changed his or her mind and moved a different direction. Mm-hmm. Those are frustrations of which I am not unfamiliar. Yeah. I am quite familiar with those kind of frustrations. Even still, as recent as this week, I know what that feels like. And what I've learned in this process is that everyone who is not fully in charge, and there are only a few who really are, everyone knows what that feels like. Those are very common frustrations that everyone has. And so the lie that I'm hoping to convince people of is that you don't need to leave the job you're in. Now, you might. In fact, every one of us is probably not in the last job we'll ever be in. But just because you have frustrations doesn't mean you need to leave. There's actually a way to cultivate influence in the seat that you're in. And that's not something that is just an ideal for me. It's something that I deeply believe.
Yeah. Well, you actually, in part two of the book, you actually outline four behaviors that you think are critical to developing leadership. And I think this is something that anyone can get started on, regardless of where they are in their own journey. But the first one seems to be self-explanatory, but it seems like when I talk to young adults, it's just difficult to understand and apply. And that is the concept of leading yourself. I think everyone thinks we do this better than we really do.
You're absolutely right.
What does this, in your mind, give our audience a taste of what this actually constitutes? Does this mean like just buckling down with self-discipline? What would you say is the most important takeaway on that point alone?
Well, I mean, just for me, what's been most impactful is you've got to know where you are to begin to lead yourself, and that's humbling. And there's a number of questions that we try to use within our organization to try to help discover where you are. One of them is, what is it like to be on the other side of me? I've got a really good friend named Jeff Henderson who taught our whole organization that question a number of years ago. And if you want to know how well you're leading yourself, ask a few people that question. A few people that you trust that know you well. What was helpful for me was to ask my boss, hey, imagine, just hypothetical, there's a job that comes open that would be a promotion for me. Let's say someone said, hey, what do you think about Clay for that job? what would cause you to hesitate on recommending me for that job? What are the things that are actually areas of my work life that would give you pause? Because whatever that is, those should create the areas that we should lead ourselves within. And that's not easy to do. That's pretty humbling to do. The last job change I had about 2.5 years ago, I did a little informal 360, which was incredibly helpful, incredibly humbling for me. But I asked everybody on the team that I worked with 3 questions. What did I do that inspired you? What did I do that frustrated you? And what do I not know about myself that you think is a blind spot? And those 3 questions created such crystal clear areas where I needed to grow. People over and over again, this was about 50 people that took this little informal survey. They said things like, hey, when you're in meetings, I feel like sometimes you're not present. You feel like you've already checked out and you've already moved on. Sometimes when you're listening to me, I feel like you're waiting for me to finish so you can tell me what you think. And those are all things that I know are true about myself. I was just hoping no one else knew they were true about me, right? Which is common with all of our blind spots. But they created for me areas where I know I need to grow. And so in this new role that I've been in the last 2.5 years, I've tried to be much more deliberate about letting people know how present I am in meetings and how prepared I have tried to be for meetings and for whatever the next thing on the calendar is. So that's to me, leading yourself is easy if it's an ideal, but it's hard when it hurts. And it should hurt, because all of us have areas that we need to grow, and we're not better off by not knowing them. We're only better when we can cross that intersection of acceptance, which naturally, when we get feedback about ourselves, it feels like rejection. But if we can move across that intersection, then we can start to learn some things about ourselves that formulate a plan on how we can lead ourselves. Yeah. So that's the crux of that section.
Yeah. You also talk about the value of thinking critically, and I'd love you to put that in context for, you know, again, talking to that 20 or 30 something who's like, look, Clay, all I do is come to work every day. I book other people's travel. I type the same report every week. My bosses don't even encourage me to think. So how in the world am I supposed to break out of that box and actually start moving in with some ideas that may or may not be received by those in my working sphere?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite things to talk about, because I usually talk about it right after I've talked about attitude. Attitude is incredibly important. In fact, none of us are in charge of everything, but all of us are in charge of our attitude. It's probably the greatest way that you can bring benefit to the people around you today. It's true for me. I mean, greater than my education, talents, giftedness, whatever, my energy of attitude is really the best thing I can bring. And so I'll tease that out for people, and I can see it begins to frustrate a few people. It's usually, you know, being positive is not just a personality trait. It really is a choice. But for some people, their personality lends toward that. And people that don't have that trait, they're not negative, they're just realistic people, I have found. No one calls themselves negative, but they're just realistic people. And so I usually tease that out, and I can see people's faces begin to get frustrated, because people that aren't naturally positive, people think, yeah, but somebody's got to make a difference around here. Somebody's got to tell everybody that wasn't the best weekend ever, or that wasn't the best meeting ever, or that wasn't the best event ever, that there were things wrong with it, there were things we can do to grow. And what they're doing is they're actually thinking critically, which is a really healthy thing to do. But when you couple positivity with the habit of thinking critically, there's a real power there. There's a synergy there that happens inside of any one of us. I saw this headline about millennials recently. It said, millennials, are they misguided optimists or rainbow-puking unicorns? And I thought, that is the most disturbing and most amazing image that my brain has ever conceived, a rainbow-puking unicorn. That's what people that are natural critical thinkers, people that are super positive, make them want to throw up. They get nauseated by them, because they know that, like the Lego movie says, everything is not awesome all the time. So learning to harness that gift or that skill of thinking critically is powerful. And there's really 3 simple things that all of us can do to think more critically, because this is I really believe it's something you can get better at. You can clear space in your calendar to teach yourself to do this. You can carve out some margin in your day to start planning for the next meeting, to start thinking through what you just experienced so that you can make things better. But those three little habits are noticing things, questioning things, and connecting things. Just by noticing things, just by being present and going, interesting, why is the... You do this in restaurants. You go, why are the lights so dim? Or why is it so bright? Or why is the music so loud? Or why is it so soft? Critical thinkers are great at noticing things. Then they question things. They're naturally curious. They ask, why does that happen? What happens if you flip it over and turn it the other way? What happens if you made the font a little bit smaller? Or if you change that color, what would change? And then they connect things. They make connections between what they notice, the answers to what they question. And they do all of that in an effort to make something better, to bring some value. So if you're in that job today and you feel stuck, you feel like, well, I'm just managing somebody else's calendar, I'm just getting someone else coffee, I run the same reports every single day, you still have an opportunity today, wherever you are, to lift up your eyes, to look around, and to begin to notice what could change around here. What could get better? What is that problem that nobody has found a solution to? And then you can ask some questions about it in a very honoring way. And then hopefully, through making some connections, you can bring some value, even if it's not in your area of responsibility. And that's the hardest thing, is what do I do about things that I notice or question or connect that are outside of my area? And in the book, I try to talk about how do we do that? How do you bring up something if somebody's in another department or somebody's on another team that you think would add value? But as soon as you start adding value, somebody that you work for is going to see that. And I guarantee you that in the same way Jesus says, hey, if you can be trusted with a little, you can be trusted with more, that adding value is something every employer is looking for.
Yeah. Well, and there is so much good stuff in there. You touched on it a little bit about the whole concept of, yeah, when you need to maybe challenge authority or present an idea that's not, you know, you're not in charge of the outcome of that, but how do you share ideas
exactly
without coming across as, you know, entitled or arrogant? I do want to, since we're running out of time, so folks, again, the book, you got to get a copy. In fact, we're going to give it this week as a gift of any amount to Boundless. We're going to get you a copy of this in your hands. So you need to get a copy of this book. Like I said, this is applying to every person, I am sure, who's listening today, how to lead when you're not in charge. Okay, Clay, as we finish up here, here's a question I get a lot. What, yep, waiting in our career, how much do we wait for opportunities to present themselves and how much do we go after them, take them, or ask for them in the workplace? Because there's this idea, especially among boomers and above, that we have to pay our dues, wait, bide your time, you know, fold your hands and look helpful. But now we're being told by all these leadership experts, oh no, you got to go out, you got to grab it, you got to, you know, make your way to the top, you got to make it happen. Is there a balance in that, or what's the way to apply that well?
Well, you know, it's one of the things that is, it's a paradox about anybody under the age of 30. I have found I'm right on the edge of the millennial generation, and I see this within myself, that I got a trophy for everything I did. I got a certificate for everything I completed and didn't complete as a kid. And I was told from a young age that I could be president of the United States of America, and it's not working out for me. And it's created this interesting dynamic inside of me where, on one hand, I feel very opinionated. I feel very confident to be able to shoot for the moon. But at the same time, I feel very risk averse. I feel like, well, I didn't grow up with monkey bars on the playground, and I didn't learn how to fall off the monkey bars. And so what do I do if I feel this urge to step out, but then I feel scared to step out? I think everybody listening probably can relate to that on some level. And the truth is, the way I have seen it done really well is, I think all of us need to start small, and we need to find that closet in our organization that needs to be cleaned out, that no one wants to clean out. And we need to start there. The problem is that most of us want to start with the glamorous task, the project that's going to get all of the attention. But the best place to start is with the closet that, in our organization, it's the one that we ask summer interns to clean out the first week of their job. But every organization has something like that. It's the problem that keeps coming up in the meeting, but nobody has time to find a solution for it. Or it's the project that nobody wants to work on because it's not the glamorous one. And what if you just started there? What if you said, hey, I'm going to take initiative to say, hey, is anybody handling this? Is anybody working on this? No? Okay. Well, then I would like to take a stab at trying to fix this or trying to make this better. And as you add your flavor and your critical thinking and your value to that project, I think you're going to become someone who's worthy to be handed more. So in a way, they fuel each other. Of course, being completely passive and sitting back and waiting, that's not the way to move forward. But being too aggressive and grabbing things that that are beyond where our seat is also dangerous. But I think every one of us has something around us that we can pick up and go, hey, is anybody working on this? Is anybody taking a stab at this? Okay, well, I would like to try. So hopefully, even today, as you're listening, you can think about that closet in your organization that needs to be cleaned out. And for some, it might be a literal closet, but for others, it's probably a figurative closet. But I would start there. I would take initiative and say, hey, I'm going to bring some value to that.
Yeah, that's great. Well, good thoughts there. And again, folks, the book is How to Lead When You're Not in Charge, Leveraging Influence When You Lack Authority. Great thoughts in here that we haven't even had the chance to touch upon today. So get a copy of the book by hopping over to Boundless.org. You'll see the image of the book cover there. Click on it, gift of any amount to Boundless, and we'll get this in your hands. We'll also link to Clay's website and all the info there. So Clay, thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time to share from your spectrum of leadership experience, as well as where you're going in the future, and you don't even know what that entails, because I would agree.
That's right. None
you
of
say
us do.
You have not arrived yet, though.
That's right.
You know, though some of us would think you have, but thank you so much for being here as part of the show today.
No, thank you, Lisa. Honestly, this is a blessing for me, and it's a complete honor just to get to have this conversation with you. So, thank you.